And when I cast my mind back to that summer of 1936, these two memories of our first wireless and of Father Jack's return are always linked. So that when I recall my first shock at Jack's appearance, shrunken and jaundiced with malaria, at the same time I remember my first delight, indeed my awe, at the sheer magic of that radio. And when I remember the kitchen throbbing with the beat of Irish dance music beamed to us all the way from Athlone, and my mother and her sisters suddenly catching hands and dancing a spontaneous step dance and laughing, screaming like excited schoolgirls. At the same time, I see that forlorn figure of Father Jack shuffling from room to room as if he were searching for something, but couldn't remember what. And even though I was only a child of 7 at the time, I know I had a sense of unease, some awareness of a widening breach between what seemed to be and what was, of things changing too quickly before my eyes, of becoming what they ought not to be.
That's Michael, who plays both the narrator and a character in a 1990 play by Brian Friel, Dancing at Lunasa, in which he looks back to 1936 and the late summer days when love briefly seems possible for 3 of the Mundy sisters, Chris, Rose, and Kate, and the family welcomes home the frail elder brother Jack, who has returned from a life as a missionary in Africa. Ireland in 1936? How promising is that for a happy ending? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What does Dancing at Lunasa have to say about being able to go home again? And what is inherently Irish about it? And for that matter, what does it take to bring that play to life? Well, our guests are involved with the University Theatre production of Dancing at Lunasa, which will run from October 4th through the 19th in Madison. They're Claire Mason, the dramaturg for the production, Jim Stauffer, who just now read the part of Michael but will be playing the part of Father Jack, and also with us, the director, Patricia Boyette.
Oh, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's an interesting play, and Patricia, let's start with you and the mm-hmm. choice of doing this. Mm-hmm. What made the play mm-hmm. stand out for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, there were practical reasons. There's 5 women, 5 lovely roles for women, so we always cherish that. And the play itself, for me, one of the first impressions I had after reading Dancing at Lunasa, and I've never seen a production of it. The film, I think the play is far superior to the film. And I continue, it's one of those plays, it's such a play of language. Brian Friel really is a poet, and I'm finding the more I get into this play, the more I find. So that's particularly delicious. But what really struck me after reading the play and rereading it was that it reminded me so much of members of my own family, my grandparents, who were alive and adults during the Depression in this country, worked very hard. They're people like, in most people's family, I think you can relate to people who work very hard and they don't make it into the history books. They don't make a huge splash, but through the lives that they've lived and what they've given us, they're really heroes. They're really unsung heroes. And I see the Mundy sisters as being like that. They've made such a profound effect on Michael, just as my grandparents have made on me. And I think there's something very, very human about that, very relatable.
Not making a splash is one thing, but not making a living is another thing.
It is. It is. And how they survive. I mean, you know, the times we're in right now, I'm not saying that it's the 1930s and it's not the 1930s Ireland, but I think there's things we can relate to in terms of there's the sisters, 2 of the sisters make a living through cottage industry, knitting gloves, and a knitting factory comes to Ballybeg, and they are without that little pittance of work. They're without, and I think we can relate to that in some of the shifts that have happened in our own time.
And there's a single mother.
There's a single mother, and there's a single mother in very Catholic Ireland.
Well, a single unwed mother.
Yes, and this is the time of the Magdalene sisters and what was going on with, you know, unwed women really, really had a hard time and were thrown out of society, essentially. It was this family bringing her in and protecting her that...
Well, Claire, let me ask you, as the dramaturg, I've read in some of the write-ups about the play that it's somewhat autobiographical. To what extent? I mean, whenever I hear that, I want to know, okay, what was really part of this playwright's life and what was fiction?
Well, it certainly has been found to be slightly autobiographical of Frias's life. He was inspired for the idea when he encountered his two aunts who had gone off to London, and so the characters of Agnes and Rose are based on his own aunts. Quite a bit of the play itself, though founded in his own autobiography, also are speaking to more than just his own background. It's talking about what it was like in Ireland at the time, but also Ireland in his present. And so while it's based in his own autobiography, I would probably be a little hesitant to say it is an autobiographical play in itself, as the characters aren't his actual aunts. He is not Michael, but there is a lot of Friel and his own heart and his own past in the play.
Is it inevitably a little bit nostalgic? I mean, I realize we're talking about hard times and a hard place with things getting harder, but if we're talking or seeing this series of events through the eyes of a narrator who lived through it as a child, I think most people tend to be nostalgic for their childhood, no matter what the hardships. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense that this is a fond look back at these difficult situations?
Well, as Claire was saying, although there's a bit of autobiography in this, Friel is also, as a poet and as a philosopher, looking at much more than just nostalgia. And he's looking not just at 1930s or 1930s Ireland, but also present, and also philosophical questionings having to do with the civilized and the pagan, or what is innate and what is structured in our society, and what is the tension between them, the religious and the secular, the primitive and the constructed. There's all kinds of things. So as Michael is looking back to this summer when he was 7 years old, Friel has interwoven some questionings that the adult Michael has about life, essentially. So it's very layered. It's not a simple play at all. There's a lot of philosophy in it. Friel has used some of the same conventions that Tennessee Williams used in The Glass Menagerie,
yes,
as Thornton Wilder used in Our Town. And in those plays as well, there are characters that reminisce, but it's not just a reminiscing. It has to do with philosophical questionings.
And you have these layers of irony between the contemporary narrator, what he understands, and what he as a seven-year-old boy understands.
Yes,
in these situations.
There's a discovering of that. There's a discovering of that.
Well, let's also talk about the character of Father Jack, because one of the things that seems to trigger a lot of the change in the play is that Father Jack has come home. Can you set up, you know, who is this character? Where has he been? Why has he come home? And
Jim, do you want to talk to that? Jim is playing Father Jack.
Well, just to harken back to some of Friel's autobiography in this play, Friel was actually forced into the priesthood at a very early age and jumped ship after several years and said it was one of the most horrible experiences of his life. So you probably can see that a little bit in Father Jack. Even though he identifies with the Catholic religion, he has definitely embraced the pagan rituals of this Ryangan group. So he's been in Africa for the last 25 years working in a leper colony. And for some reason, he was sent home. That reason is never explained specifically in the play, but definitely you kind of understand why after you meet him.
And why is that?
Is this the something hint? Out of the Heart of Darkness yeah. by some
he's
chance?
He's gone native?
he's gone a little native, yeah.
So he's sent home because he's not being an Orthodox Catholic priest or because he's actually engaged in something that's gotten him into trouble?
Mm-hmm.
It's not
you
spelled.
Have to,
it's
have
not.
To see it.
It's mm-hmm. not spelled out, but it has to do with going native. He's embraced some things that are not within the Catholic
way
theology.
Of doing things, not
right,
Orthodox.
Right, uh-huh. right. But what's lovely about Father Jack is that he embraces the innate, what might be labeled pagan or primitive, as well as the Catholic structure. He takes what's best from both of them and doesn't worry about what isn't in either. And so he's really a fantastic, lovable character. In one sense, some people see him as a fool and losing his mind. But in a sense, he's one of those characters that spiritually transcends reality and is so positive in embracing whatever is good from wherever it is.
Well, and certainly to go and work for that many years in a leper colony mm-hmm. seems to epitomize embracing anything human.
And he talks to the sisters about how open-hearted and wonderful the Ryangans are, not unlike us, and how they have such a love of life. And this has become a part of him as well. It's very interesting with the characters. There's not any characters that are white hat and dark hat. They're a combination of being very, very human with wonderful qualities and flaws as well. Jerry Evans is a ne'er-do-well who is the father of Michael, who comes back irregularly. He's in and out of their lives. And he goes off to fight in the Spanish Civil War for democracy. But it's really, he just wants adventure and somewhere to go, some cause or something. And there's tension in the household about that because Kate, the more dyed-in-the-wool Catholic, points out that the Catholic Church is supporting Franco. So for Jerry to get involved with the International Brigade,
fighting against him,
which is fighting against him for democracy, it's a very complicated thing going on there.
Do you have the sense that Kate is the centerpiece of this piece, if there is one? I mean, she, as the kind of the controlling figure and the one who represents in some regard mm-hmm. the strictures in which these people were brought up. I mean, she's mm-hmm. going to be at odds with Jack, who's been here in Africa going native. She's going to be at odds with Jerry, who is this mm-hmm. unmarried, freewheeling husband and married or not mm-hmm. to one of the sisters. Mm-hmm. It sounds as if Kate is going to be crossing swords with most of the people in this play.
Mm-hmm. She definitely is the most Catholic of all of the sisters and all the characters in the play, actually. She's more Catholic than Father Jack as well.
I suppose.
But I don't see her as central. All of the sisters, all of the characters bring in their own take on the tension between many things, but the Catholic and the secular, for one, different philosophies, which makes for a very textured tapestry in this play.
There's a passage where Kate talks about sort of trying to hold the family together. I was wondering if we could hear that. I know we don't have the Kate that's in your production, but Claire, maybe you could share that.
You work hard at your job. You try to keep the home together. You perform your duties as best you can, because you believe in responsibilities and obligations and good order. And then suddenly you realize that hair cracks are appearing everywhere, that control is slipping away, that the whole thing is so fragile it can't be held together much longer. It's all about to collapse, Maggie.
Love the accent you got there. That's got a beautiful lilt to it. You know, she seems to be working so hard. Do we ever get a hint in the play? I must have missed it if it was there as to what's happened to the parents and why she is in this position of trying to keep a whole family, including a sister with special needs, why it has fallen on her.
We have the sense that she represents those parental values, though.
Yes, definitely. I mean, she's the parent now. So we don't know how long the parents have been dead. There's a little bit of dialogue about the mother working very hard and having corns on her feet and different things, but very little. But we have a sense that Kate has been keeping things together for quite a while.
And it would make sense, too, that she would fill in as that parental character, because no matter what their ages are, as soon as the parents have died, especially in this time period, you have a household of unmarried women. No matter what the age, they're the responsibility of the eldest. And so in lieu of Father Jack's being in Uganda, she would have to take responsibility. And so there would be a necessary idea of her as the parent, because she has to take care of sisters, not only with special needs, but with a child out of wedlock. And in a society where anything that goes against the social norm is a bit of a death stroke to a family's financial abilities, can be really problematic. And she manages to keep this family going until the male figure arrives, and it's his otherness that is eventually the large economic blow to the family.
Well, that actually does raise an interesting question. So if there had been a male figure who remained in the house, he would have been the one in charge. Yes. But the two male figures we're looking at, one of them just sort of comes around when he feels like it, and the other one, having been gone for a quarter of a century, comes back impaired and unable to fill that role. So, in fact, you actually have Kate calling the shots even when Jack has returned.
And what's interesting with that, too, is there's a moment after the dance and Kate's trying to regain control. And she has this line where she says, "This is Father Jack's home." Just never forget that. It's not their home, even though they're the ones who live in it. He can't remember the layout. It doesn't matter. They're the women. It doesn't belong to them.
Tradition is strong.
Exactly. And had she been able to be the figurehead of the family, she probably wouldn't have lost her job, and they probably wouldn't have become destitute.
Right.
But it's because he is a figurehead.
Right. So Kate teaches in a Catholic school, teaches children in a Catholic school.
She's the only one who's employed, isn't she?
She's the only one who's employed outside of cottage industry knitting that two of them are doing. So when Father Jack comes back and he's denied saying Mass because he's gone native, and because he's gone native, Kate loses her job. I mean, it's the family stigma that's come about. And Father Jack in this little community of Ballybeg was a rock star because of his spending 25 years in Africa as a Catholic priest doing missionary work. So this offset one of the daughters being pregnant out of wedlock and the shame of it. There was a bit of a balance, but now the balance is again shifted.
As soon as people find out what was going on in Africa.
Yes, exactly.
Well, and it's better to have a hero off at a distance than to find out that there he is and maybe there's some flaws.
Right.
We're going to listen to the voice of Father Jack when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, who are all involved in a production of Dancing at Lunasa. That's Brian Friel's 1990 play, being produced October 4 through 19 by the University Theater in Madison. And our guests are Claire Mason, who's the dramaturg for the production, Jim Stauffer, who is playing the part of Father Jack, and the director, Patricia Boyette. And as long as we've been talking about Father Jack, who really seems to set everything in motion with his return after 25 years in Africa, going from hero to family liability, what kind of character is this for you to play, Jim? Where do you begin?
Wow, where to begin? But the first thing that I fell in love with Father Jack just because he's a kind and gentle soul. And as Kate states in the play, he has found his own, help me out, he has found his own...
his own distinctive spiritual search.
Own distinctive spiritual search, which I can identify with in my own life. He has malaria. He came back from Africa with malaria. And when you first meet him, he sort of shuffles around. He doesn't remember his sister's names. He's kind of out of it. But boy, he can remember the stories in Africa. And I was telling the cast the other day about my grandfather. He could remember later on in his life. He could remember what happened to him when he was a kid, but he couldn't remember what he had for breakfast the day before.
Sure. So, yeah. Pretty common.
So he's just a lovely character, and it's been a pleasure and an honor to make him come alive.
And is there a passage that would give us a sort of sample of Uncle Jack's voice that you could set up for
Absolutely,
us?
Sure. This passage is when he is describing the festivals of the New Yam and the festival of the sweet cassava to his sisters. So... Well, the Ugandan festivals begin very formally, very solemnly, with the ritual sacrifice of a fowl or a goat or a calf down at the bank of the river. Then the ceremonial cutting and anointing of the first yams and the first cassava, and we pass these around in huge wooden bowls. Then... the incantation, a chant, really, that expresses our gratitude and also acts as a rhythm or percussion for the ritual dance. And when the Thanksgiving is over, the dance continues. And the interesting thing is that it grows naturally into a secular celebration, so that almost imperceptibly the religious ceremony ends and the community celebration takes over. And that part of the celebration is a real spectacle. We light fires round the periphery of the circle, and we paint our faces with colored powders, and we sing local songs, and we drink palm wine. Oh, and we dance. And dance, and dance, oh, children and women and men, all dancing. Many of them were lepers, many with misshapen limbs, with missing limbs, dancing, believe it or not, for days on end. It's the most wonderful sight you have ever seen. Oh, and that palm wine. You lose all sense of time. Oh, yes, the Ryangans are all remarkable people. There is no distinction between the religious and the secular in their culture. Oh, and their capacity for fun, for laughing, for practical jokes. They have such open hearts. In some respects, they are not unlike us. Oh, you would love them, Maggie. You should come back with me.
Do we know, Claire, did Brian Feil have any kind of African experience, or is he just riffing here? In a sense, it's more fun if he's just making it all up.
There's a fairly good chance that Feil is riffing it. As far as I'm aware, he has not had any special trips to Africa. He has a tendency to do a lot of writing about different places, different historical time periods, without actually knowing much about it. Though in this particular case, there is a lot of factual historical information, which would, I would guess, he probably, but I'm not entirely sure, he either knew someone or did a lot of research. And so there is a background there without his actual.
But he is is saying, I think, under all of this delicious monologue here, that you can't go home again.
Right. I think there's also something. I think part of what's in the play that I'm sure was a fascination for him and a major theme of the play is he really compares the African primitive culture with the Irish Celtic culture. The masks are very much the same. There's several similarities. And I think part of having Father Jack in Africa all this time, part of it is to point up that this also exists in Ireland.
Well, and there's a sense of liberation when he's talking about sort of not having those inhibitions and sort of celebrating having this openness. And we've already experienced with the sisters that they're longing to go to the dance and not have to play the role of the old maid who shouldn't be doing
absolutely.
That anymore.
Absolutely. And we haven't talked so much about this radio, this Marconi radio they get, that as was in the first speech that we started with, it's sort of a radio because it shorts in and out and in and out and in and out.
It's kind of but a character when, in its own right.
Right,
isn't it?
It is. So there's popular music of the 30s and also Irish music that comes on. And when that comes on, their lives are instantly changed and then it goes off. And navigating that irregular shorting in and out is interesting. And there's a major dance that the sisters have in this play that in spite of themselves, they are absolutely thrown into this abandon that comes about through the music on the radio that works on them and gives them permission to throw off their worries for that point of time and just abandon themselves to this primitive, if you want to say, surrender.
So is this
to the music.
Sort of the sisters' equivalent of palm wine?
Yes, very much. There's so many comparisons and weaving in and out of that primitive culture, whether it's Africa or the Celtic and the straight-laced Catholic culture.
Well, tell us about the title, too, and the special festival that's behind the title.
In the play, Dancing at Lunasa, you're going to go into the theater expecting dancing. But I think one of the really beautiful things that Feil has done, using dancing as a sort of metaphor for the various things that are happening in the sisters' lives, it's not just the Riangan people's dance or the sisters' dance to their radio. There's also sort of a marital rite that's done in dancing. And there's the ideas of the kites that dance at the end and how dance becomes the movement that can overshadow language. And you have the whole play, Father Jack is always searching for words. The play ends with the loss of the ability to speak and tell a joke on Maggie's part. And so as the language sort of deconstructs and breaks down, the movement and the emotions that can be allowed to come through when one dances, free from Catholic politics, free from the society that's entrapping everyone in this play. And so dancing becomes more than just what we're seeing, but also an idea that encompasses everyone in the play.
Right. There's, from the very end of the play, Michael's speech at the very end, picking up on what Claire just said. But there is one memory of that Lunasa time that visits me most often, And what fascinates me about that memory is that it owes nothing to fact. In that memory, atmosphere is more real than incident, and everything is simultaneously actual and illusory. In that memory, too, the air is nostalgic with the music of the 30s. It drifts in from somewhere far away, a mirage of sound, a dream music that is both heard and imagined, that seems to be both itself and its own echo. A sound so alluring and so mesmeric that the afternoon is bewitched, maybe haunted by it. And what is so strange about that memory is that everybody seems to be floating on those sweet sounds, moving rhythmically, languorously, in complete isolation, responding more to the mood of the music than to its beat. When I remember it, I think of it as dancing. Dancing with eyes half closed, because to open them would break the spell. Dancing as if language had surrendered to movement. As if this ritual, this wordless ceremony, was now the way to speak. To whisper private and sacred things. To be in touch with some otherness. Dancing as if the very heart of life and all its hopes might be found in those assuaging notes and those hushed rhythms and in those silent and hypnotic movements. Dancing as if language no longer existed because words were no longer necessary.
That's really,
Isn't that
was beautiful and very poetic.
And that gets back to what you were saying earlier, Patricia, about kind of stripping away these layers until you get ritual goes away, even language goes away, and then you're down to just this kind of essence of the dance.
Yes,
and that
absolutely.
Which would unite both the Ugandans and the Irish.
Yes.
When you get right down to the root of the humanity.
And the human. Mm-hmm.
Now, the image there was of people sort of dancing or floating alone, but we also have scenes where Michael's mother is dancing with the ne'er-do-well,
yes.
And he's now a dance teacher.
And that's that's interesting. Claire was referencing that a moment ago. This is a big shift. When Michael, the 7-year-old, watches his parents dancing, there's something that happens in that dance where it is their marriage ceremony. And although his father goes off, his mother is not prone to depression this time. There's something that happens that transcends, and there is a love there that's just acknowledged. It just is. And things are no longer as problematic as they were before.
And up to this point, she seems to, Michael's mother, she seems to look forward to each of these visits and with rising hope each of these visits from his father, and then the hope dashed
right.
every time he goes
right.
away again. But there's something different about this.
This
with
one
the
is
dance.
Different, and it happens in the dance, that there's some kind of acknowledgement that there is a love bond there, and everything else is secondary to that.
What does the play suggest about sexuality? I mean, we have this love child, Michael. So obviously there has been sexual contact.
Mm-hmm.
There's also worry about Rose and what might happen to her.
Mm-hmm.
These women are kind of hungry for something.
Right. Romance, sexuality, it's referenced the love connections that the sisters have, and many of them are in the past, that came so close but no closer, and then, you know, the opportunity for coming together with a love connection, a marriage. There's a reminiscence of these things in the past.
And all their friends seem to be getting married. There's references to other people, other people having twins, other people having ceremonies.
Right, right. So there's a tension and there's a discussion of that. And, of course, there's always the Catholic Church and there's the secular what is expected. And then there's the realistic of where you find love in life. And life is messy. It doesn't go according to a certain path. And how they navigate that, how they navigate that. I don't know. Claire, do you have anything to add to that?
I'd say one could certainly interpret the play as having a lot of sexual undertones because you do have Chris having Michael out of wedlock and Jerry coming back and referencing that they've never made love in a tree. And you have Rose going off and everyone knows what Danny Bradley is going to do to her in the backwoods. And so you do have layers that if you chose, you could kind of go in that direction. And there's a little bit of alluding to is there or isn't there something more substantial going on between Jerry and Chris's sister, Agnes, as well. But I think to really play up that sexuality would be disingenuous to what Friel's actually talking about, because it isn't about a women's sexual liberation. It's about family and home. And I think Father Jack has a really lovely way of talking about it, where love children are a blessing for the Ryongan people, and how the way that this family is set up, and you have one man with four or five wives, and they all take care of each other, and it's like a little commune, which is exactly what's happening in this family. And it's not that Chris went off and had a sexual dalliance and had this child and now they're covering it up. It's that there's something beautiful about this family and this commune, and Jerry's part of that. He's the cock of the walk with all of these hens around him. And there's something, I think, more pure, something that has that romance and that the love that goes with family and all of the different ideas of commune and taking care of each other, especially in a community like Ireland where it's very uncommon.
I love it when Jack says, you know, I would wish you all had love, Jack. Children to the sisters. Wouldn't that be great? And then it takes a village and, you know.
Let's hear that.
Let me set it up for you. I just found out that Michael is a love child, that Chris is not married. When I first find out that, and I think all the sisters are looking at me, it's like, oh no, Catholic priest, how's he going to respond to this? And he responds by saying, in Ryanga, women were eager to have love children. The more love children one has, the more fortunate your household is thought to be. Have you other love children? And then Kate says, no.
Well, rough break. See what you can do there. This play is very much, as we say, centered on this family. Do we have any sense of how they compare to the neighbors? Does it all take place in their cottage? And if so, what do we have for comparison?
It does all take place in their cottage. The cottage is a little ways away from the town, and so they walk to town, don't have a bicycle, although swear they're going to get a bicycle, but don't have a bicycle. So it's a bit of a distance, and it's like any small town, very gossipy, and things are good when they have Father Jack as this hero who's sacrificed, and he's the Catholic priest and all of that. And then things disintegrate a bit when they don't have that hero. So you have a sense of community in some ways. I mean, Agnes and Rose knit the gloves, and there's a definite community with the town through that. And Kate is a school teacher in the town. But they're more and more isolated as their fortunes,
their situation
take
becomes
a downturn.
Known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
More at Dancing at Lunasa when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Last winter, All that sobbing and lamenting in the middle of the night. I don't think I could go through that again. And the doctor says he doesn't think Father Jack's mind is confused, but that his superiors probably had no choice but to send him home. Whatever he means by that, Maggie. And the parish priest did talk to me today. He said the numbers in the school are falling, and that there may not be a job for me after the summer. But the numbers aren't falling, Maggie. Why is he telling me lies? Why does he want rid of me? And why has he never come out to visit Father Jack? If he gives me the push, all five of us will be at home together all day long. We can spend the day dancing to Marconi. But what worries me most of all is Rose. If I died, if I lost my job, if this house were broken up, what would become of our Rosie?
That's the character of Kate in Brian Friel's 1990 play Dancing at Lunasa, which is being produced by the University Theater from October 4th to 19th. We've got with us the director, Patricia Boyette, who's filling in the part of Kate, and also Claire Mason, dramaturg, and Jim Stauffer, who's playing the character of Uncle Jack. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. We have these five sisters, and Kate is struggling to keep things together, as we already talked about. And that final part where she talks about Rose, mm-hmm. and what do we do about Rose, can you say something about the character of Rose? Because we're not ever quite sure what the disability is,
No. Rose is described, the closest that we know is from the script, is that she's described as simple. But it's pretty apparent that she has some kind of learning disability, so that the sisters are very protective of her and see her as being particularly vulnerable. Although she's an adult woman, there's something childlike and naive and vulnerable about her, so that when she meets this man who wants to take her to the back hills and go to the festival of Lunasa, and she actually sneaks away to be with him, they're absolutely panicked. And the responsibility that you heard Kate speak about, if something should happen to her, she particularly is worried about what would happen to Rose. And again, this time, the families have to take care of.
So we have we have a childlike adult, but we also have a child in this play. And how does he tie in?
7-year-old Michael is born out of wedlock, love child. And this summer that he experiences is a turning point in his life, and it's the pinnacle of what he sees as this the height of this loving family being brought together. It's like the harvest itself at this time of year. Everything's come to fruition. And after this, the winter is going to come, both literally and figuratively. The family disbands. But I think as an adult, we figure this is about 20, 25 years later, when he thinks back about this summer, that my sense is that Michael is at some turning point in his life, and he gathers strength by reflecting back on how his mother and his aunts got through, and their strength.
And are we meant to think that Michael, like some of the characters of Tom, for example, in Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams, who's going to write poetry on the boxes of shoes and so on, are we meant to think that Michael is a writer?
I think so. The language is just too rich for him to be anything but a writer. We talked a little bit about how parts of this play are autobiographical, and I think Brian Friel definitely connects with Michael.
And he's making kites. What can you tell us about the image of kites, and how are you going to kind of show some of that on stage if we come and see your production?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, the image of the kite is something that can fly away
freely.
Yeah, freely.
It dances in the
wind.
It
dances in the wind. All of that. None of that's accidental. It's, there are many layers of metaphor and similes and images in this play. The kite also, the image on the kite, the audience doesn't see until the very end. And I'll just say that the image on the kite refers very much to African masks, to Celtic masks. On one side of the stage, at the very end, there's these masks that are the kites, and the face of the kite is seen just at the end of the play. The audience never sees it before that, though some of the characters do. And on the other side of the play, there's a picnic that's being laid, but the picnic is really in itself a ritual that on it has the eight plates for the eight characters. It has, well, I'm adding a couple of things, a bowl of apples, it has a loaf of soda bread, and it has the sacrificial rooster in the middle. We haven't talked about that. But there's an occurrence in the play where Rosie's pet rooster, that all of the rest of them are just annoyed by, but this pet rooster, the fox gets in and kills the rooster.
There's a few metaphors, symbolism, staining by berries.
But there is a bit, well, more than a bit. There's the Last Supper on one side, and then there's these pagan images on the other side. And
Summarizing again this contrast between the
exactly
the primitive and the artificial, I guess you could say, the imposed,
the constructed, right.
We've mostly talked about the serious side of this play, but there is quite a bit of humor, too.
It is Irish, after all. It seems inevitable. There is, and the Irish tie it together like nobody else. A lot of the humor comes from the relationships of the characters and this boomeranging off of each other as they're navigating these extremes in their lives, actually. There's a lot of polarity that the characters are having to dance between and the way they do it. So there's a lot of humor in that, the way there is, again, in any family who in tight quarters are dealing with some very important issues, and we watch them boomerang and spark off of each other. And some of the characters, Maggie is a wonderful character we haven't spoken of so much. And Maggie is one of those people who deals with adversity through humor. And she's always telling riddles. And she's always...
And not very good riddles.
Not very good riddles.
She likes them. Right. So her way of coping is to, when things get too serious, is to try to bring it back and to make a joke. And she's a wonderful character. She sings. She's the one who picks up on imitating the popular songs of the 30s. So she sings a cappella several of these things as she goes about her work and really sees herself as... she parodies being a film star or being a popular singer as she goes through her work. So there's a lot of play in that as well.
I wonder if the two of you could read the scene where she's going back and forth with Uncle Jack, and he's suggesting maybe she could go back to Africa with him.
Yeah. Maybe I should go to Rianga with you, Jack.
I know you won't, but I know you'd love it.
Could you guarantee a man for each of us?
I couldn't promise four men, but I should be able to get one husband for all of you.
Would we settle for that? One between the four of us?
That's our system, and it works very well. One of you would be his principal wife and live with him in his largest hut.
That'd be you, Kate. Stop that, Maggie.
And the other three of you he'd keep in his enclosure. It would be like living on the same small farm.
Snug enough, girls, isn't it? And what sort of duties would we have?
Cooking, sewing, helping with the crops, washing, the usual housekeeping tasks.
Sure, that's what we do anyway.
And looking after his children.
That he'd have by Kate. Maggie!
Oh, by all four of you. And what's so efficient about that system is that the husband and his wives and his children make up a small commune where everybody helps everybody else and cares for them. I'm completely in favor of it.
It may be efficient, and you may be in favor of it, Jack, but I don't think it's what Pope Pius XI considers to be the holy sacrament of matrimony. And it might be better for you if you paid just a little more attention to our Holy Father and a bit less to the great goddess Iggy.
I have to ask you, Jim, how do you play this scene? Is Father Jack loopy, or is he serious? Is he just making a joke of the whole thing? It seems to me there's a little bit of latitude there with this part at this point.
Yes, I agree. I believe he is excited. That's my take on it. He's, like he says, he's completely in favor of this lifestyle where everyone's living together and helping each other out and caring for them, much like the sisters are now, but sans husband. They're without a husband, and they die without husbands, too, where the alternative is, well, you can come to Ryango with me, and I can get you a husband, and you'd have everything you're doing now. So,
yeah, it complicates things. It's interesting because the sisters all they do succumb to poverty and to hard times. That if there were at that time, if there were one man there, it might be different. Their future might be different. So he's introducing an interesting concept here.
Well, it's also a little ironic because the sisters are actually taking care of Uncle Jack. Yes. And they're, when they talk about going to the dance, they say, but there'd be nobody to stay home with Jack. So they are sort of providing him with that village or that commune or that helping place.
Exactly. And the men that are in their lives, as we mentioned earlier, aren't much help in terms of that role that iconically they were supposed to uphold of being the provider. It's actually the sisters that provide for the men in this.
So final question, what do you hope an audience that would come to see your production of Dancing at Lunasa would go out of that theater and take back into their own life? This is a place set in the 1930s, written in 1990, set in Ireland, but here we are. Mm-hmm. So if they go back out into the, you know, Madison, what is it you want?
Ireland, nice place to visit.
I think it comes back to being very human. I hope that they get from this. I mean, there's several things that Friedel's working with, but for me, an appreciation of those, and I'm putting this in quotes, little people who are our predecessors, who have maybe not made an earth-shaking difference to the culture, but for us personally, they've made a huge difference, just as this family has done for Michael. The unsung heroes that we have in our own lives, to acknowledge them, to take a moment out.
The little people, I thought you were going to be talking about leprechauns.
Yeah. No, there's that. It's probably in there. Actually, that is in there somewhere. But for me, this is what it boils down to, and I think this is the most important core.
The extraordinary ordinary people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The name of the play is Dancing at Lunasa. It's by Brian Friel, and University Theater is producing it October 4th through the 19th at the UW-Madison, and the director has been with us. That's Patricia Boyette. The part of Father Jack is being played by Jim Stauffer, also with us, and the dramaturg giving background on the whole thing, Claire Mason, also was our guest today. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us the next time around for University of the Year.